Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray Episode 2 is brought to you by two great sponsors, and they include Hunt a Killer, a monthly subscription that provides an interactive story for you to explore through investigative means, straight to your doorstep, and Audible. Audible provides an unmatched selection of audiobooks, original audio shows, news, comedy, and more. Get a free audiobook with a 30-day trial at www.audible.com/undisclosed. Also, we want to remind our listeners that the research, analysis, and opinions of the investigators, journalists, academics, and lawyers who you'll hear on this program about the circumstances surrounding Freddie Gray's killing are just that. Research, analysis, and opinions. We encourage listeners to reach their own conclusions and to vigorously debate our conclusions with us. Enjoy the program.
Baltimore City, 911, operator
732,
what's the address of your emergency?
Yes, the 1700 block of Fulton is witness assault, and I
was
going
to file a complaint.
Okay, sir, can you please repeat that
location?
Man, I've been recording.
And your phone number?
I would like to stay anonymous.
I hear those screams sometime in the night. Mm-hmm. I wake up, my wife asks me what's wrong. And I say, I just can't sleep. I keep hearing that boy.
I was sitting where I was at in the kitchen. I could see in the window they were chasing somebody. They were chasing them down Bruce Street.
Yeah.
And I could see that. And by that time I got to the door, I was going down to the corner. He started hollering.
Like him? I mean, beating so bad. He didn't deserve it.
I didn't have anything to hide. I didn't have anything to do with any part of that. I was in my bed. I just happened to be up at a time that this was going on. I heard this man hollering, "Why are you grabbing me?"
Like I said, before I even opened the window, I could just see the police van, and I knew, like, well, somebody out there get locked up. At this point, I'm just telling my girl, but by the time I look out the window, I'm like, damn, that's Pepper. Like, that's what we call it. We call it Pepper, so...
Last week, we introduced the timeline of events. The official story is given by the Baltimore City Police and readily accepted by the state's attorney's office that chronicled the arrest, injury, and death of Freddie Gray. That timeline, the six stops, and nearly everything ever reported on what happened at each of them comes from a very specific set of witnesses, the very same police officer defendants who were charged in Freddie's death. Now, this should give you some pause. In any criminal matter, it's the job of the prosecution to seek out justice based on the truth to determine the facts of the crime. Have you ever heard of a prosecutor relying only on the defendants themselves to determine those facts? I haven't, ever. Especially in a case where there are clearly other witnesses. Witnesses to Freddie's arrest and his injuries. Witnesses to who he was as a person. Witnesses to his life and witnesses to the kind of life lived where he was raised. Gilmer Holmes in Baltimore. Hi and welcome to Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray. My name is Rabia Chaudhary, and I join my co-host Marsha Chatlin, Amelia McDonald-Perry, and Justin Barron in bringing you this week's episode.
I'm gonna buy a paper doll that I can call my own.
There's a ray of sunshine in the talk of family heads at the Gilmore Homes, reported the Baltimore Afro-American newspaper on July 4, 1942. The Gilmore Homes in Baltimore's Sandtown-Winchester neighborhood, or just Sandtown, opened to rave reviews from the first 264 tenants who moved into the new housing project. Built to alleviate some of the rampant overcrowding in Baltimore's black neighborhoods, these homes provided much-needed relief for black defense industry workers who were supporting World War II efforts as machinists and shipyard workers. Mrs. Jerome Brooks said that she appreciated the cleanliness and the absence of rats and mice at Gilmore. The Bruce family, a family of four who moved into 1646 Bruce Court during the war, did not miss their previous accommodations. The entire family had all lived together in one rented room. Their new apartment was close to Mrs. Bruce's local church and the NAACP meetings she liked to attend. And the two Bruce children finally had their own room. The Afro-American described the newcomers to Gilmore Homes as one big jolly family. A reporter painted this idyllic scene of life at the Homes. Watching the tots play in the protected areas and crossing the threshold of the airy, fresh units and seeing the clean interiors brings a sensation that might well provoke miles of smiles. Decades later, this is how the Washington Post describes Sandtown. Drab row houses line street after street, forsaken little mom-and-pop stores around the corners. The boarded-up houses run in the hundreds, and there is not one plot of green open space in all of Sandtown Winchester's 71 square blocks. This is how a reporter described the West Baltimore neighborhood where Freddie Gray grew up. On July 2, 1980, 9 years before Freddie was born, only a few miles away, in the other Baltimore, crowds gathered to celebrate the dedication of a newly renovated Harbor Place, a $20 million project promising to bring much-needed jobs and tourist profits to the city. While some parts of Baltimore enjoyed improvements and investments throughout the 80s, 90s, and up to the present, Sandtown was and has been largely left behind. In many ways, Sandtown is like many communities of color that have been left behind by the loss of jobs, the loss of population, and the loss of resources. And just like these communities, Sandtown's stories, its people, and its now departed son, Freddie, can teach us so much about the difference between life and death in America and the fact that it's often a matter of where you live. For the millions of people who watch cable news segments or read news articles about the Freddie Gray case, all of West Baltimore may have been one place in their minds. That place is the West Baltimore of the television series The Wire, David Simon's wildly popular HBO show from 2002. In reality, West Baltimore comprises a collection of neighborhoods, each with its own stories and memories and sources of pride. Where some see vacant townhomes and shuttered school buildings, others remember the days of Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall's youth in Baltimore. Some recall their grandparents' tales of growing up with jazz great Cab Calloway or making the acquaintance of Billie Holiday. Black Baltimore, each section of it, each moment of it, has its own histories of better days, more population, stronger community associations, and more local businesses. Yet all of these communities that make up the tapestry of West Baltimore have been bound together by the experience of racial discrimination in housing, bank lending, job creation, business loans, school choices, and in their relationship with the Baltimore Police Department. In telling Freddie Gray's story, we untangle the wire of false narratives and judgments about a place called Sandtown in a city called Baltimore.
If you're enjoying Undisclosed Investigation into the Killing of Freddie Gray and you'd like more context on Freddie Gray's Baltimore, then we highly recommend that our listeners go to Audible to download the audiobook They Can't Kill Us All, Ferguson, Baltimore, and a New Era in America's Racial Justice Movement by Wesley Lowery. Conducting hundreds of interviews during the course of over 1 year of reporting on the ground, Washington Post writer Wesley Lowery brings alive the quest for justice in the deaths of Michael Brown, Tamir Rice, and Freddie Gray. They Can't Kill Us All is a must listen, so we're asking everyone to go to Audible to check it out. In fact, Audible is offering our listeners a free audiobook with a 30-day trial membership. Just go to audible.com/undisclosed, download it for free, and start listening. It's that easy. Audible content includes an unmatched selection of audiobooks, original audio shows, news, comedy, and more from leading audiobook publishers. Audible also has a great listen guarantee. If you didn't like that book, you can swap it. You can also share a book from your library with anyone, and if it's their first time accepting a book through this feature, they can listen for free. And remember, if you're new to Audible, you can listen to a free audiobook with a 30-day trial membership. Go to audible.com/undisclosed, download a title, and start listening. That's audible.com/undisclosed, and get started today.
Portal Mercedes 911, operator 132, what is the address of your emergency?
Yes, the 1700 block of Fulton is witness of assault, and I was wanted to file a complaint.
Okay, sir, can you please repeat that location?
1700 block of North Fulton.
And your phone number?
I would like to stay anonymous.
Okay, and can you give me a description of the person that was assaulted?
Yes, it was an incident falls with the officers involved, and actually, I said, witness the officers assault this guy, and I have it on camera, and I want to file a complaint. I'm on, you know, they told me, I tried to go down to Western District, and no one came down to the door. I don't know why, because it's a Sunday, so this is my next best step.
Okay, let me tell you where the problem is going to come in, because you want to remain anonymous, and you want to report.
Okay, I don't mind remaining or not. I mean, I give my name when they get here.
Okay, well, I have to be able to let the officers know who you are. Does that make sense? So they know who they're going to ask for.
Rodney Clark.
Okay, and was it that an officer assaulted another individual there?
Yes.
All right, sir. I'm going to go ahead and put in this information.
Yes.
And we will get an officer out there to you.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
At 9:39 a.m. on April 12th, exactly 1 hour after the chase that led to Freddie's death began, a man identifying himself as Rodney Clark called 911 to report the police for assault. He had a video, and he wanted to file a complaint. This man was actually Brandon Ross, Freddie Gray's best friend of a decade and one of the two friends he was walking with on West North Avenue that morning. Brandon used his father's name rather than his own because he didn't want to be harassed by police. Remember Brandon Ross's name because he was an important part of Freddie's life, an important part of this story, and we'll be talking about him a lot over the next few episodes. Brandon wasn't the only member of the community to witness what happened that morning at Gilmore Homes. He wasn't the only person to have video either. The day after Freddie was hospitalized, where he remained unconscious and in critical condition, his friend Kevin Moore uploaded footage to the internet, which immediately captured the public's attention. A few days after that, another video of the arrest surfaced. This one was shot by Kevin's friend, Kiana Craddock. Thanks to the two of them, Baltimore authorities couldn't sweep what happened to Freddie Gray under the rug.
Shorty, that was after they tased the out him like that. Man, I've been recording it. I've been recording it. What car they come out of, yo?
He on a bike, yo, right there. Him right there, he on a bike.
I got it. Don't worry about it, yo.
Get his badge number, his chump badge.
After they did tase Joe like that, you wonder why he can't use his legs. Yeah, I sure will.
Hey, his leg look broke. Look at his leg. Look at his leg. That boy leg look broke. His leg broke and y'all dragging him like that.
Both videos showed Freddie being dragged to the transport van by one of the bike cops, Officer Edward Nero, and a uniformed police officer who would be later identified as Zachary Novak. Officer Miller followed behind them to the back doors of the van, where Officer Caesar Goodson stood. Freddie's legs were limp. Hell, his entire body was limp, and his neck looked oddly contorted. Freddie was a very dark-skinned black man, but in the video Kevin shot, he almost had a charcoal-y green undertone. He does not look well. Kevin's bedroom is on the third floor of his Gilmore Homes apartment. For some reason, houses around here don't have doorbells, so getting the attention of someone who's not on the first floor requires a very, very loud knock, or more often, a loud, "Hey, yo!" bellowed from the street. On more than one occasion, someone in the neighborhood took pity on me and my weak knuckles. "He might be upstairs. You gotta yell," one guy said before stepping back a couple feet as if to give his diaphragm more room and bellowed for me. On the morning of April 12, 2015, it was his uncle's shouting that woke Kevin up and had him hustling downstairs and out onto Presbury Street with his phone in hand. Here's Kevin explaining to CNN's Anderson Cooper how he came to film what many believe was Freddie's last few minutes of consciousness.
I was actually in the bed asleep, and one of my relatives came running in the house screaming my name. "They're tasing him, they're tasing him, they're tasing one of your friends." And then I run out the door to try to, you know, see what's going on. But by the time I got to the actual site that it was happening, I didn't see the taser or the taser. He was putting it back in the holster rather than tasing him still. And so then I just whipped out my phone and started recording, man.
Freddie's scream. It's a sound that still haunts many of the witnesses I've spoken to over the last 8 months. They returned to it again and again as they shared their accounts of what they saw police officers do to Freddie, first on Presbury Street during his arrest by Nero and Miller, and then one block away on North Mount and Baker Streets, where Nero, Miller, and Lieutenant Brian Rice pulled him out of the transport van to shackle his feet. Freddie's screams roused people from their beds, got them to turn down their television sets, and made them pause their Sunday morning routines.
It was about 8:30 in the morning, and I was surfing the TV channels. We generally look at Jamal Bryant or Dante Hickman on Sundays, the preachers. And I was searching the channels for them. And my wife was there laying in the bed asleep.
This is Harold Perry. In his 70s, Harold's vision has deteriorated to the point where he walks with a cane and wears dark glasses. He's not completely blind, however, and the sun on April 12th shined brightly upon the scene occurring just across the street from his home on the corner of Presbury and Mount Streets. I'd guess that nearly half the houses in the neighborhood are boarded up or being used by squatters. Harold's home, which he owns, is one of the nicest on the block. He proudly pointed out the updates he and his wife had made to the property over the years. Steel awnings, a new paint job, and most recently, a huge mural dedicated to Freddie Gray, painted by the artist Nether, on the Mount Street-facing side of the building. The mural was Brandon Ross's idea, and Harold agreed right away, provided they didn't use any profanity. The finished piece is a portrait of Freddie flanked by freedom fighters of the past and present. Dr. Martin Luther King and other civil rights movement protesters to his left, and on the right, some of the friends and neighbors, including Brandon and Harold, who marched for him during the Baltimore uprising. After the mural was unveiled, Harold had only one small change he wanted them to make. Instead of black flags flying in the background, he wanted the stars and stripes.
I hear those screams sometime in the night. Mm-hmm. I wake up, my wife asks me what's wrong. And I say, I just can't sleep. I keep hearing that boy.
Yeah.
And that's what gave us the instinctive courage to put that mural on the wall.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Was hearing his screams laying right there in that driveway where that lieutenant was on his back, yeah, telling him, "Shut the F up."
Was one of the few people to witness the initial few seconds of Freddie's arrest before his screams woke up the entire neighborhood. Being blind, Harold relies on his hearing to make up for what his vision lacks, and the noise produced by Freddie's initial detainment immediately grabbed his attention and drew him over to the window. He was able to make out the two bike officers by their bright yellow and blue uniforms. They were dragging Freddie from the middle of Presbury Street over to the sidewalk and in front of the handicap ramp near Gilmore Homes' Bruce Court entrance.
I didn't have anything to hide. I didn't have anything to do with any part of that. I was in my bed. I just happened to be up at a time that this was going on. I heard this man hollering, "Why are you grabbing me? Let me go. I haven't done anything." And by the time I got to the window, they were pulling him over to that turd right there.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw him put him down, and his head was up on that little ledge.
Mm-hmm.
He was on his front.
Mm-hmm.
And the big guy was on his back, and the little guy was trying to twist his arm to hold him.
So his arms were like this, or his arms were like above his head?
No, he didn't have the other one had his arm, and the other guy was trying to twist his arm behind, mm-hmm, his back. And he said, "Let me go." And the big guy got right on his back. That big 300-pound bicycle rider got right on his back. And he immediately screamed, "Get off my back, you're hurting my neck. I have asthma, I can't breathe."
I am not the first reporter to interview Harold Perry. He gave his account to at least a half dozen media outlets, including USA Today and the Baltimore Sun, and they are consistent with what he told me as we stood on his stoop in mid-December, over a year and a half later. There are details he shared with me, which we will discuss in our next episode, that have gone largely unreported until now. While Harold gave a recorded statement to detectives a few days after Freddie's arrest, he was never contacted again, not by investigators, not by the state's attorney's office, and not by a subpoena to testify.
I said, "I'm going to tell everybody I can tell, because that's a damn shame, the way they're doing that young man." I talked to several newscasters. I made it very apparent what I saw on the news. And I was as accurate as I possibly could be. It wasn't any reason for me to lie about anything. I thought that someone would come and talk to me, or I might be subpoenaed to come to court. Never. Nothing.
Drumming my pain with his fingers, singing my life with his words, killing me softly with his song, killing me softly with his song, telling my whole life with his words, killing me softly with his song.
Would you buy a house for $1? That was a question Baltimore was asking in the fall of 1973, when Mayor William Schaefer announced a new urban homesteading program designed to help repopulate abandoned sections of West and East Baltimore. Initially, the city hoped to sell off up to 600 homes for only a dollar. The catch? Buyers had to fix up the houses and bring them up to code within 18 months. In 1973, the city had to deal with 5,500 vacant homes, some abandoned, others lost due to the owner's inability to make the mortgage or the tax payments. Homesteading got a lot of attention, and it inspired Philadelphia, New York City, and Washington, D.C. to follow suit. But houses for a buck could not solve the bigger problem, affordable housing for the poor. The Baltimore Afro-American newspaper explained that, quote, "Today's homesteaders are city folk. Many of them are black, and they face dangers no less frightening than those faced by early Americans in the Wild West. And lingering around the corner is the prospect of financial ruin in trying to fix a dilapidated, decaying house into a home." Over the course of 10 years, 600 houses were restored, while 40,000 people waited for nearly the same amount of time for an opportunity to live in one of 20,000 public housing units, like the Gilmore Homes.
Just around the corner from where Harold Perry lives and up the street from Gilmore Homes live siblings Alethea Booz and Tobias Sellers, who were raised in Sandtown and now live just two houses apart on North Mount Street. The day I came around happened to be a Sunday, and Alethea, who is in her early 70s, was busy in her kitchen preparing dinner for their whole family, while her niece and a friend watched the Baltimore Ravens game on TV. Preparing Sunday dinner is a weekly ritual that begins first thing in the morning, which is why Alethea was already in the kitchen cooking when she first noticed officers chasing Freddie on Sunday, April 12th.
I was sitting where I was at in the kitchen. I could see in the window they were chasing somebody. They were chasing them down Bruce Street.
Yeah.
And I could see that, and by the time I got to the door, I was going down to the corner, he started hollering. Mm-hmm. When I saw him, they had their foot down in his back, near his neck.
So they had their knee?
Their knee.
Okay.
Their knee down there. And he was hollering, you know. And when they went to get that boy up, he could not walk. He was hurt right there at that wall. Mm-hmm. We was all hollering for the police to do something and everything. They wouldn't do nothing.
Yeah.
Tobias Sellers, Alethea's younger brother, had a similar recollection. We sat at a table in his kitchen, and I was immediately struck by Tobias's body language. He leaned forward, sometimes putting his elbows on his knees, and he held my gaze. There was an urgency to his voice, like he really wanted me to understand.
First, I was upstairs that Sunday. Heard a screaming and howling. I came outside. I said, what the hell is going on? The boy was howling because the cop put his knees in the back of here, separating his spinal. And then after they took the batons and was beating on him.
You saw him with batons?
Mm-hmm. The boy was in so much pain. Mm-hmm. He was hollering. I got so pissed off and mad. And when I was right here on the steps, I seen the black cop came around the corner. I said, why don't you do something about that? He ignored me. Walked on down the street. I said, that motherfucker. My sister stopped me because I was walking up there towards. She said, no, Tobias, come on back, come on back. Because that was pissing me off.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I would have gotten in trouble, probably got beaten too. That's how pissed I was. And then after that, we put him in the cruiser, took him around the corner,
mm-hmm.
stopped up here at Mount and Baker,
mm-hmm.
right down the street. And everybody was saying this shit. The boy weighed it no more about 120 yeah. pounds. Those cops was weighing like 250.
I asked Alethea and Tobias independently of each other to show me where Officer Miller's knee was. They both touched approximately the same area on my upper back, right at the base of my neck near the spine. Alethea stores printouts of the interviews she did with the media, including one with CNN that featured her photo, in a box of keepsakes and important documents. That first week after Freddie's injury, the press seemed to value witness accounts more than detectives, who were dismissive even when they came to take their statements. I asked Alethea how the female detective who interviewed her reacted when she gave her account.
Like she didn't believe me. Anybody that had any kind of authority, you know, that I would talk to, act like
right.
he was hurt getting in the van. I say he was not hurt
yet
getting in that police vehicle. He
yes.
was not.
Yeah.
He was hurt before he got in there, and yeah. I saw it.
Yeah, yeah.
Alethea's friend diverted her attention from the Ravens game to chime in.
You know, I watched it on the news, and I could tell when they threw him in that van, he was hurt. I
yeah.
saw him on the ground when before they picked him up. His legs was like spaghetti.
Yeah. He couldn't.
You know, he was hurt then. And then they going to put him in the van head first, please.
Yeah.
It didn't happen in the van. It was
When Alethea first invited me in, her niece looked me over with some suspicion. It's over. What's the point? She said, her voice an almost incomprehensible rasp. We already didn't get justice. There's never going to be justice for that boy. Before I could answer, Alethea was already shouting from the kitchen. We have to talk about what happened to Freddie so people know. We have to get the truth out there because then maybe it won't happen again. A common refrain heard from Blue Lives Matter types goes something like, everybody hates the police until they need them. It's a simplistic argument, but I was curious whether it even had any validity. Do the residents of this community count on the police when they, you know, need help?
What do you do if you actually, in theory, need help, like to call the police for some reason?
Oh, you'd be almost dead.
You won't do it? You won't call?
You call, but it'll take forever to get here, not unless gunshots fired or a policeman shot.
Yeah.
Then it got 900 calls, but you better CYA cover your own.
Yeah.
A little while later, Tobias and I took a walk to the liquor store a few blocks away. Tobias called it The Cut, which confused me because that's also what people in the neighborhood call the skinny alleys between the row houses, like the one Freddie supposedly cut through. Cut, like cut rate, Tobias said, referring to the store's discounted prices. The cashier and all the for sale items are behind bulletproof glass. You put your money in a revolving compartment and then they spin around your purchases. As we strolled to the cut rate, he told me about growing up in Sandtown and the changes he'd seen over the years. Occasionally, we'd pass someone on the street who would acknowledge Tobias by name or a nod. Everybody knows me around here, he said. At 60 years old, Tobias has seen plenty too.
Cops in this area is just as crooked as the ones who selling drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Let me tell you something what happened. About 2 o'clock in the morning, going around the corner. Young boy was in the projects. Cop pulled him up. Young boy had a stack of money like this. Cop took the money out of his pocket. Cop saw me looking. Cop said, what the fuck you looking at? Keep on down the street. And I kept looking backwards. And then he told the little boy, get the fuck on away from here. And the cop put the money in his pocket. That's robbery.
Yeah.
I don't care who doing it, it's robbery.
Yeah.
There's a lot of these cops down here. Does, I mean, they dirty. And a lot of people now are scared.
Is that the... Is Freddie the first...
Oh, no. A lot of them been beat on.
Yeah.
But like him, mm-mm. I mean, beaten so bad. He didn't deserve it. I don't care if he did sold drugs. They need to be trained. They need to respect people as people will respect them. They, I mean, they'll go down the street in a car and they'll curse you. You say something back, that's it. I got hit. They thought I had some drugs. And I'm walking down Presbury one time and something was in the street. Says yours. Trying to make me to say. I said, it's not mine. Took the little baton thing and hit me in the back of my fucking neck while I was handcuffed. Says yours. And I'm not gonna do that.
Yeah. And what happened after that? Did they take you in?
Mm-hmm. But I told them that wasn't mine.
Did they eventually drop those charges?
Or... Mm-hmm.
And that happens a lot, right? They...
Yes, I mean, they go through all the damn paperwork. I mean, it's stupid. These judges, I think, is getting tired of that bullshit.
You would think that, I mean, it's such a waste of taxpayer money,
money,
time.
Right, right. Paperwork is stupid. It's stupidity.
The Gilmore Homes, like the other housing projects that emerged across the country to provide housing to war widows and provide safer and cleaner places to live for the poor, used to be seen as the solution to overcrowded and unsafe slums. The mass migration of African Americans to destinations east, west, and north out of the Deep South challenged racial segregation in both public housing and the private real estate market. As millions of men, women, and children sought better paying jobs, stronger schools, and respite from the racial violence of Jim Crow segregation and the Ku Klux Klan, they found themselves with limited options for housing, overcrowded kitchenette apartments where two or three families shared one room and used communal bathrooms. Eventually, after much activism and a growing public awareness and concern for the slums that housed poor families, city officials presented slum clearance as a major policy priority to fight crime, disease, and juvenile delinquency. With the passage of the Housing Act of 1937, the federal government promised money to local housing authorities to provide public housing, where residents paid subsidized rents for the maintenance of the properties. Public housing was widely applauded as a reasonable response to poverty. But public housing did not mean fair housing for all. State laws upholding segregation and organized mobs of residents who wanted to keep their public housing communities all white limited where African American families could live. Public housing solved a lot of problems, but eventually public housing became the problem, largely for one reason. The feds would pay for the buildings, but the city, using tenant rents and municipal funds, had to maintain them. High-rises, like the famed Pruitt-Igoe public housing development in St. Louis, only housed families in its 33 11-story buildings for 18 years, until the project was demolished due to its uninhabitable state. And low-rises suffered from the very forces they were designed to combat: crime, health problems, and growing poverty and isolation. By the 1990s, things had come full circle for public housing. The federal government introduced the HOPE 6 program, which dangled public funds to private developers and planners to create mixed-income developments, turning their backs on the high-rises of the past, but the focus on mixed-income housing. Some people pay full market rate, others pay a subsidized rate, also limited the number of actual affordable units for the families that needed them. Despite the attempts to revitalize cities, these programs to make improvements to housing hastily constructed and patched over again showed little in terms of improved quality of life. In the case of Sandtown, despite an estimated $130 million that has poured into the neighborhood over the past two decades, problems remain. Renovating houses, improving schools, and creating community programs does not bring jobs, economic security, and with a drug epidemic raging, it does nothing to improve relations with the police.
The first time I came to Gilmore Homes to interview witnesses, the courtyard in the center of the housing complex was completely empty except for a police car that was parked underneath the basketball hoop. In the front seat, a white officer was fiddling with his phone. I passed by him half a dozen times over the course of 2 hours, and he was still there, still doing the same thing, occupying a space that is already under constant surveillance, locked inside his vehicle, and probably stuck on level 65 of Candy Crush. For what? A few weeks later, the cop wasn't there. The weather was unseasonably warm, and a bunch of kids were out playing. I was sitting on a ledge by the basketball court writing a note to leave in someone's mailbox when a couple of the kids came over to chat. I handed over my pen and paper to a couple of the younger kids who wanted to show me their handwriting. Much better than mine, by the way. And the eldest, a girl of about nine, asked me what I was doing around there. I told her I was working on a project about a guy who lived in the neighborhood named Freddie Gray. "Oh yeah, Freddie, I knew him," she said. Before I could answer, one of the little boys who couldn't have been older than six, he piped up. "He got killed by the police," he said. During one of my more recent trips, it was too cold to be hanging around outside, but I was waiting to interview someone and didn't have much choice. I sat on their stoop on the south end of Gilmore Homes and caught sight of the drug dealers doing their thing. Pay attention, and it's really not that hard to tell who the lookouts and the runners are, where the stash is kept, and who's doing the buying. A few guys I recognize from pictures on Freddie's Facebook page. Jamel Baker was friends with Freddie. He's also the only civilian witness besides Brandon Ross to be called to testify about what happened while the transport van was still at Gilmore Homes. Jamel is a single father to a young daughter and has a regular work schedule, so while he and Freddie were tight, they didn't really hang with the same crew. Jamel calls Freddie by his nickname, Pepper.
What was Freddie like, just as his friend and...
Hilarious. He was crazy. Not in a bad way, though. Like, he was fun. He was fun to be around. He ain't take no shit, you know? I mean, he was a good person.
Yeah.
He was a real good person.
Jamel's apartment is towards the corner of Baker Street, with windows looking out over North Mount Street. He was too far away to hear or even be aware of Freddie's arrest, but the transport van's second stop was right underneath his third-floor bedroom window. One floor below is the same window in Jamel's kitchen, right next to the small breakfast table where we sat talking. From this vantage point, he had a relatively unobstructed view.
He hears screams. Like, screams like never heard before. Like,
really?
Some shit off a movie. And I was like, what is that? You know, like... Because it's nothing like I heard before. So she like, no, nothing. It's probably people just outside. You know, they always lie out. So lay back down and I hear it again. And I'm like, fuck this. I'm about to see what's going on.
Jamel peered outside but could only see the top of the transport van just below. And then his friend Brandon, who everyone in the neighborhood calls B-Lo, standing across the street and filming something with a phone. By the time Jamel got the screen out and leaned his head out the window, the screaming had stopped, a police car had pulled up, and Brandon was having a heated exchange with a black uniformed police officer named William Porter. Jamel looked down towards the transport van where he saw Officer Nero and Officer Miller standing by the back doors, their bikes in the street. One of the back doors was open, and he could see the lower half of a body jutting out of the van, the denim-clad legs draped over the bumper, knees and shackled feet upon the asphalt. The person was still. Jamel recognized his friend by his teal and gray sneakers.
I don't wear New Balance. I used to, but everybody wears New Balance in the hood. So, like, that's just the thing. Like, from Baltimore to Philly to... But it was just that particular pair that I haven't seen before. But I knew he was the first one to get them.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, before I even opened the window, I could just see the police van, and I knew, like, well, somebody out there get locked up. At this point, I'm just telling my girl, but by the time I look out the window, I'm like, damn, that's pepper. That's what we call it. We call it pepper. So I'm like, damn, that's pepper. So, I mean, wasn't really thinking much of it at the time. Like, damn, he be home later or a couple of days or whatever, you feel me? Didn't know that I wasn't going to see him again after that. So.
Yeah.
Unlike Freddie Gray, Jamel hasn't had many run-ins with police, especially in recent years since he's become a parent and had a regular work schedule. Cops in this neighborhood love to hassle young black men standing around on corners during the day, and Jamel has been there before.
They can be some assholes. They can be some assholes, and I done had experiences where I wasn't working and I was in the streets for real. It was as though I had one cop, like, and I was a juvenile. One cop, and he would bend my arm to my fucking neck and send me back home. Go up sector 3. Go back up sector 3 where you belong and shit like that. I mean, they can be some fucking
ass.
Because
you're not allowed to be out and about?
My point exactly. Like, yeah, that's how it goes down. They'll take your phones, your money, take all your shit. I mean, one time, I got locked up. I mean, it was for loitering. They do shit like that. Lock you up for loitering, trespassing, just anything to lock you up for. And it took my phones and my money, my ID and everything. So I went and got my mother. Like I said, I was a juvenile.
Mm-hmm.
Went and got my mother. And we go to the police station. And they're like, well, they don't know where none of my stuff at. But the crazy thing was, we look to the side of us, and there's a barrel right there, like a little bucket.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, give your old phones to something, charity or something. And I'm like, she looked, and she said, well, that's probably where your phone at in there. Like, you feel me? Like,
yeah.
But, nope, yeah, never got my phone back, never got my money, none of that stuff.
And did they fuck with Freddie a lot?
Yeah, Freddie, B-Lo, a couple other guys. Most of the time it's knockers, like the narcotics, it'd be them. But then you got certain beat cops that just, you got ones that'll be like, all right, look, guys, just clear it up. Don't stand right here. You got certain ones that just like, all right, this is my third time seeing you right here. If I see you right here again, then I'm lock you up. Cool. Then you got some that'll just come around and jump out. They want to rough you up, check you, frisk you and everything. Just unnecessary shit.
Yeah.
You feel me? And they'll just keep doing it. I mean, you have certain ones that just dickheads. You run from the police, we already know they're going to whoop our ass when they catch us. We just don't expect to die, you know?
Right.
By now, you've probably heard about Hunt a Killer, the murder mystery subscription box service that delivers new clues to your doorstep every month. And let me tell you, it's really addicting. I'm not the only person that thinks so. Hunt a Killer has been featured in BuzzFeed, Fast Company, and the editors at Bustle are writing weekly about their experience. Hunt a Killer puts your true crime sleuthing skills to the test, and you don't even have to leave your house. The stories unfold with an ongoing creepy correspondence. Things like letters, articles, objects, and tools. All from a Hannibal Lecter type killer curator. One of the best parts about Hunt a Killer is the online community of armchair detectives that work together on the mystery. And people really are obsessed. It's like living in your true crime series. There are secret Facebook groups, forums, podcasts, and live videos to contribute to the experience. And it's exclusive. All you have to do is apply for membership at huntakiller.com. They only let a few hundred new members in a month, so don't wait too long. To help support our show, they've offered a 10% discount for our listeners. Use the code SOLVE and get 10% off. So head on over to huntakiller.com and register now.
Shortly after Freddie's death, Sandtown became the area of focus for the city's leadership. What could be done to help the 8,500 people who lived within Sandtown's borders? Help came in the form of volunteers. local leadership seeking to reconnect with Sandtown youth, and programs like Jobs Plus, a $2.5 million grant from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development to improve job skills, education, and financial literacy in the neighborhood. Also on the city's radar was the condition of Gilmore Homes. But Gilmore Homes was not only important because it was where Freddie lived. Gilmore Homes was also the center of an $8 million class action lawsuit brought forth by 19 women who had claimed that they were told they could only receive repairs to their housing units if they had sex with maintenance workers. The women claimed that by refusing the maintenance men's advances, they were forced to live with mice, faulty heating, and exposed electrical wire. The $8 million came from the Housing Authority's insurance policy and from their reserve account, which is funded by the federal government. Although the majority of people killed by police are men, girls and women living at the economic margins find dangers inside and outside of their homes.
Jacqueline Jackson lives in another housing project on Mount Street across from Gilmore Homes. She witnessed the transport van's second stop when police pulled Freddie out of the van to shackle his legs.
I was in my kitchen cooking. I was cleaning up my kitchen. When I looked out the window, I seen them had Mr. Gray. The police had Mr. Gray and threw him up in the paddy wagon head first.
They
threw him up in there because all this was buckled and this was behind him.
Yeah.
I told them, what is y'all doing to that young man? They told me I need to mind my MFing business. And I told them it is my MFing business. Why would y'all throw him up in their head first?
Mm-hmm. Did you hear a sound like you heard him hit?
Yeah, I hear something like, wow. Like that. You know, you can hear because everybody was out on the street, but it wasn't loud,
yeah.
You know, where, you know, the streets is real loud.
Yeah.
But you hear it that.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You can hear him, you know, making noises like, you know, he's in pain.
Yeah.
And a person know when another person is in pain. But it's just sad.
Did you notice a reaction from the police officers after they did that?
They looked scared.
They realized?
Yeah, they looked scared. All of them looked scared. You know, after that happened, it was like they booked the skid.
Yeah.
Jacqueline thought about going to get her phone so she could record what was happening, but she also didn't want to miss anything. She'd known Freddie for years.
I had young men.
Yeah.
You know, that could have been my child.
Yeah.
That could have been one of my nephews.
Mm-hmm. Did you know him at all?
Yeah.
Yeah. What was he like?
Real nice young
man. Yeah.
I knew him as a young man, then, you know, watch them blossom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all kids do things, but, you know, he wasn't no better than the other ones. You know, everybody's child do things, but,
yeah.
You know, he wasn't that bad that he deserved to lose his life. And, you know, they was harassing him. That's all they do is harass the black young men up here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if they can't find nothing on you, they go and put something on you.
Yeah.
Jacqueline shared her account with the media, but was never contacted or interviewed by detectives. She also didn't hear from prosecutors until many months later, before the first trial started.
And so when the state's attorney came, and I took him in my kitchen and explained to him what I had saw, and they said, Miss, you didn't see that. I said, so what you telling me? What you calling me, a liar? He's like, no, I'm not saying that. I said, but I know what I saw. They didn't want me to say nothing else, but I know what I seen.
Yeah.
And my daughter told me, she was like, Ma, is your right to tell what you seen? She said, because, you know, that young man is dead from these police doing what they did. You shouldn't be silent. You need to go ahead and tell what you seen.
Mm-hmm.
For a brief time, it seemed like the witnesses to Freddie Gray's arrest were going to be given the opportunity to help tell the story of what happened to him. If you recall from our last episode, police were initially cagey with information about Freddie's arrest. They provided a timeline that left half an hour unaccounted for. They denied any use of force and ignored Kevin Moore's video. Journalists filled the gap in the story by interviewing eyewitnesses. First on the scene were the local TV network affiliates, especially Jane Miller of WBAL News.
North Avenues. The city's camera system recorded the van that arrived to pick up Allen, the same van that at the very same time was carrying Freddie Gray. Allen did not.
Miller is a well-regarded local reporter known for breaking stories. She identified the first witnesses to stop two who had a lot more to say about it than the police. Jane Miller will turn up in our podcast a few times. For almost a week, Baltimore residents watched and read daily accounts of people who had separately witnessed excessive force at Freddie Gray's arrest, who saw or heard tasers, who heard him say he couldn't breathe. They heard from his loved ones who saw him at the ICU, all bruised up, in a coma. And then they heard the police say that no force was indicated, repeatedly. So that is the context within which the first wave of organized protests was born. A week later, just after Freddie Gray's death and a little late to the scene, the Baltimore Sun also began including witness testimony in their reporting. By this point, Freddie Gray had become national news. Media outlets around the country descended on Baltimore, mostly critical of the police's dance around the truth. The eyewitnesses were the national news at first. The Sun, Guardian, New York Post, Daily Mail, CNN, New York Times, and others featured Kevin Moore, Harold Perry, Keona Mack, Tobias Sellers, a woman who would only give the name Rosa. Freddie Gray had been seen in a, quote, crab-like position, they repeated, or folded into a pretzel or origami. For a few days, the witnesses to Freddie Gray's arrest seized the national spotlight, and then they disappeared from media. Not all at once, but almost all at once, and almost completely. In the TV show Mad Men, Don Draper teaches Peggy Olson a fundamental rule of advertising. If you don't like what's being said about you, change the conversation. Through a combination of luck and strategy for the police, the conversation about Freddie Gray shifted away from them withholding the truth about possible excessive force to a flurry of other stories. Battles between bats and the Fraternal Order of Police, leaks about Freddie Gray causing his own injury, and especially the protests and riots.
Baltimore is burning. After a day of looting and rioters clashing violently with police, tonight a community center in flames lights up the city as police and community activists try and take back the streets. Let it shine.
In my neighborhood.
Lost to chaos earlier today.
Baltimore was on fire, and that became the pressing story for journalists. That meant no more talking to witnesses or taking time to look closely at the CCTV videos released on the 24th. Those videos would, put together with witness statements, tell a story that might have helped protesters more effectively challenge leadership. Oh, but a mom was beating up on her kid for being out on the streets of Baltimore protesting. A young black man being minimized, shamed, and abused was a shinier object for a 24-hour news cycle. By implication, the cause that drew the local community into the streets in the first place was also minimized and shamed. The riots only lasted a couple of days. The protests died down, but the witnesses never made it back into the spotlight. Something else helped shift the conversation more permanently away from them. So if you remember, on April 20th, the mayor stepped forward at the press conference to say that, quote, whatever happened, happened in the van. That was widely quoted. Then, the lawyer for the local Fraternal Order of Police, who represented the involved officers, echoed this sentiment. Quote, our position is that something happened in the van. We just don't know what. Media picked up on these statements and drew a conclusion. Freddie had maybe, possibly, been given a rough ride.
The incident has touched off a week of protests, including some violent scuffles. Protesters claim Gray was the victim of what's known in Baltimore as a rough ride. Police intentionally stopping short and driving erratically.
Still looking for answers, and tonight we are learning a little bit more about why people in this city are saying a rough ride in a police van may have contributed to his injuries.
That kicked it off. 2 days of feature stories on Rough Rides by the Baltimore Sun, Daily Beast, NBC, New York Times, BuzzFeed. Even liberal independent websites wrote about Rough Rides. All of this before any evidence was released to support this theory in the case of Freddie Gray. The Rough Ride story benefited BPD. It gave the community something to focus its anger on without looking too closely at that complicated, suspicious arrest that involved six officers. More than six, actually. So if Freddie Gray was killed by a Rough Ride, then whatever the witnesses saw was what? Just some preliminary extra abuse? What, it didn't happen? They all conspired together to lie? Or Freddie was just screaming to get attention? Which the cops will later claim in court. Once six officers were charged by Marilyn Mosby, it didn't seem to matter. Never mind that the cops who were most involved with the arrest were charged with second-degree assault, not first-degree, not actual violence. WBAL's Jane Miller continued to report on the Freddie Gray case. She broke the real identity of the other passenger in the van, for instance, forcing the Washington Post to print a correction.
Dante Allen is a 22-year-old West Baltimore resident who was picked up by city police the morning of April 12th on suspicion of a minor offense. It happened at the corner of Pennsylvania.
And then she stopped reporting on the case altogether. You see, Jane Miller is in a long-term romantic relationship with Janice Bledsoe, who would become the lead prosecutor on the case. Miller stepped back to avoid any conflict of interest. At least the witnesses had a moment to tell their stories to media. At least Tobias Sellers, Alethea Booz, Harold Perry, and the others are on record for generations to come. The people in charge of the official investigation, the police department, and state's attorney's office, didn't give them even that much importance. They did act like they cared. On April 24th, Commissioner Batts asked witnesses publicly to come forward and help. Only by then, more than a dozen were already on record in mainstream media, ignored by police. Through our investigation, we have learned more about how little attention was paid to these witnesses, which we will discuss in future episodes. When the state finally dismissed the last two cases against the police officers in July 2016, the trials were over and the gag order was lifted. The two lead prosecutors in the case gave a press conference. They were asked about their investigation and whether they had interviewed witnesses.
And you have to understand that the community is very reluctant to give names and addresses, but our investigators were out there every day.
Again, a dozen or so witnesses were not reluctant to share their names with mainstream media. Her colleague, Michael Schatzow, was asked about Alethea Booz in particular.
There are some witnesses, including Alethea Booz, I believe, who said just yesterday to one of our reporters that she was never interviewed, and she asserted that investigators didn't interview witnesses. So can you just address that specific point?
The name doesn't ring a bell with me. I don't want to talk about her because I don't know what her situation is.
A reminder that Alethea Booz had been interviewed extensively by the Baltimore Sun and appeared on ABC and CNN. But for one of the lead prosecutors in the Freddie Gray case, her name didn't ring a bell.
While we've interviewed many witnesses from in and around Gilmore Homes who are happy to go on the record about what they saw, we also know there are many others who chose to stay quiet, then and now. Shortly after Freddie's death, Kevin Moore told the Baltimore Sun that he had spoken to neighbors who were scared to come forward because they feared police retaliation. He was too, and it turned out with good reason. Before he posted his cell phone video of Freddie's arrest online, Kevin hand-delivered the footage to Baltimore police, and he gave a recorded statement on the same day that Freddie was injured. For the following week, as friends and family prayed for Freddie to pull through, Kevin laid low, allowing the video to speak for itself. He didn't come forward publicly as the videographer until after Freddie died. In an interview with the Baltimore Sun on April 23rd, Kevin gave his witness account. Quote, "They had him folded up like he was a crab or a piece of origami. He was all bent up. He said, 'I can't breathe. I need a pump.' And they ignored him. The police yelled, "Stop resisting," but there was no resistance. He couldn't move. Kevin insisted that both he and his uncle had heard a taser being used, which was contrary to the Baltimore Police Department's contention that Officer Miller had only taken the taser out but had not deployed it. Kevin also scoffed at the police's claim that only one of the CCTV cameras in the area had captured any part of Freddie's arrest. Quote, "If I were to commit a crime, they would have every angle," he said, referring to the abundance of City Watch cameras in high-crime neighborhoods, including six within Gilmore Homes alone. "It doesn't make any sense that these cameras work, but when the police do something, they don't." As it turned out, Kevin was right to call the BPD's bluff. There was more than one working surveillance camera that filmed Freddie's arrest. On the afternoon of April 24th, the day after Kevin's Baltimore Sun interview was posted, the Baltimore Police Department released footage from 16 City Watch cameras that allegedly captured at least part of Freddie's arrest or the transport van's route. Trust me when I say we'll be spending quite a bit of time dissecting the hell out of that footage throughout the season.
One thing that couldn't be missed on the CCTV footage, Kevin Moore. He can be seen standing in the middle of Presbury Street on footage from two cameras. The same day the videos were uploaded to BPD's YouTube, the department tweeted a screenshot from one camera where Kevin was the most obvious focal point. "Detectives need help identifying the witnesses in this photograph," they tweeted, going on to encourage anyone with information to call the police. But BPD detectives already knew who Kevin was, since he had given them his video and a recorded statement, not to mention attracted all sorts of unwanted attention to the case by uploading the footage. There's no way anyone involved with BPD's investigation into Freddie's death looked at that CCTV footage and was like, I wonder who that guy could be. Besides, Kevin had given that interview to the Baltimore Sun the day before, which prompted at least a dozen other blogs to write about him and his allegations. But maybe that was the point. Maybe Baltimore police didn't like that Kevin was suddenly speaking out. Kevin certainly saw the tweet as a threat. Quote, "What is so important that you have to plaster my picture all over the internet? I've already spoken," Kevin told the Sun the day after the tweet. "How do you not know that picture is me? For the police to post that picture and say you don't know who I am, that's BS. You know who I am." On April 30th, Kevin and two friends from Ferguson, Missouri, who both work for Cop Watch, an activist organization that documents police misconduct, were arrested after leaving a protest in West Baltimore. Well, Kevin's friends were arrested, that is. Kevin was just taken down to the Western District Station and wasn't released until the following day, without any charges being filed against him. Here's Kevin talking to Vice News the day after his overnight detainment.
"I was arrested last night on some false, bogus intimidation shit. Like, they really tried to intimidate me. They really tried to intimidate me, and they took me down to precinct for 6-7 hours. I don't get no charge papers. I don't get no citations. I don't get none of that. So what am I being charged for? You know what I mean? What am I being detained for? Show me some type of love, because believe it or not, 80% of the officers that was in that precinct were my descent, African American. And you can't give me an answer.
What
I don't
did
get
they
my
tell
phone
you?
Call.
Did they charge you with anything?
No.
Just violating curfew, basically.
No.
No.
No, because I got caught before curfew. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I wasn't in violation of anything. Right. I never even got a citation.
Right. So they just, like, let you go the next day, just this morning?
You know, they dropped me off back where they found me, man. They knew that if they didn't give me back to my people, that it was going to be crazy.
Kevin's friends were each charged with disorderly conduct and rioting, charges that were dropped months later. Kevin wasn't deterred by what he considers to be police harassment. In June 2015, he started a Baltimore chapter of Cop Watch, and he continues to document police activity. The first time I tried to get in touch with Kevin was back in late July 2016, as the trial of Lieutenant Brian Rice was coming to a close. Since then, I've emailed, called, Facebook messaged, had mutual connections put in a good word, and have knocked on his door on at least six different occasions, with no luck. I kind of don't blame him, though. One mistrial, three not guilty verdicts, the rest of the charges thrown out, case closed. And what has Kevin been left with? Quote, "They pull their cameras out on their little cell phones and they record me," he told The Guardian's Baynard Woods about the ongoing police harassment. This was in July, just a few weeks before I tried to contact him. "I'm tired of this bullshit," Kevin said. I've got three kids that I gotta leave here after I die. You think I want them fighting the same shit that I'm going through right now? I'm trying to leave this earth knowing that I made a mark on this earth and my father made a difference is what I want my kids to say. In the end, bro, what am I really fighting for?
We've opened for you a small window into the world of Freddie Gray, his friends and neighbors, and the place they call home, Sandtown. A world in which a police presence hangs over their heads like a sword, a constant intimidation. A world in which your word as a witness to the events surrounding you carries little weight or importance to the authorities. Heck, it's a world where witnessing the wrong thing can get you in trouble, like it did for Kevin Moore. In Sandtown, walking down the street or hanging on a corner can land a young man in jail. Which is what Freddie Gray was trying to avoid when he began running after the cops were chasing him. Now, people say, hey, well, he shouldn't have run if the cops were coming after him, but that's a pretty lame way of avoiding the more important questions that we as citizens who are protected by the Constitution and laws, who care about civil liberties for everyone, should be focused on like a laser. Why were the police pursuing Freddie? What did he do? Why did they arrest him, and were they justified? We dive deep into Stop One, the arrest, next time on Undisclosed.
Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray, Episode 2, was co-produced in part by Justine Barron and Amelia McDonald Perry. Justine, Amelia, Dr. Marsha Chatlin, and Rabia Chaudhry co-wrote the episode. Jason Henderson helped with research for this episode, and Saad Chaudhry consulted. Our audio was produced by Rebecca Lavoy of Partners in Crime Media, and the two great podcasts, Crime Writers On and These Are Their Stories. Methil Telhan is the super producer that brings everything together and makes sure that you get a new Undisclosed podcast every Monday and Thursday at 6 p.m. Our sponsors ensure that we continue to fund and produce this investigation, so we want to give thanks to Hunt a Killer and Audible. If you want to listen to it, Audible has it. With an unmatched selection of audiobooks, original audio shows, news, comedy, and more, you'll find what you're looking for. Get a free audiobook with a 30-day trial today by signing up at www.audible.com/undisclosed. Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez composed Undisclosed theme music. Nina Musser and Christy Williams design and maintain our website. That's www.undisclosed-podcast.com. And Baluki does our graphics. Make sure you stop by on Thursdays at 6 p.m. for the Undisclosed Addendum featuring Dee Watkins. From the addendum, you're going to get an intimate discussion led by Dee with important context that we hope deepens your understanding of policing, crime, race, poverty, and politics. Follow Dee on Twitter at DeeWatkinsWorld and ask him questions about the episode with the hashtag FreddieGray or the hashtag UDAddendum. Lastly and leastly, Undisclosed executive producer is Dennis Robinson, and he looks forward to Thursday for the Undisclosed Addendum featuring Dee Watkins. Until then...